Hello, 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 and welcome. Oh, just one second. There we go. Hello and welcome to the Velvet Studio, home of Ottawa's queer media. A little earlier, George Michael, eh? Well,
I don't know. Yeah, I was. Yeah. I was wondering about that too.
Yeah.
But what led a sportscast to decide to end on that song?
That's
probably made sense when they chose it.
Mm-hmm. Something to do with the saxophone.
I don't know.
But anyway, that happens. But we have a great show lined up and two fantastic guests. Thank you so much for joining. And before I introduce the two guests today, I just want to kind of give the folks listening a bit of context as to what the show is. Also, because Sebastian keeps reminding me, my name is Luke Smith.
And I'm Sebastian.
And we're the hosts for the show, which is the Velvet Studio. And this is week four of our Refugee Month of Programming. It happens all the time. So week four. So week one, we talked about with the resettlement officer, Michael Casasola, who you may know. In week two, we talked with Nicholas Hirsch, the immigration lawyer, who you may also know. And then in week three, we talked to Graham Reed, who is the director of the LGBT rights program for Human Rights Watch, who you may not know. And now this week we are joined by Lisa from the Capital Rainbow Refuge, and Eve, who's with a new group, hoping to also bring somebody here as well. So this week we're looking, really practically speaking, how do you get someone in the door and across the border. So welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for the invitation. It's great to be here.
Thank you, Luke.
Excellent. So I'm going to just tweak that a little bit. So yeah, it's going to be... So what's the process look like? So I mean, I'm sure we got listeners who are thinking, you're right. It's such a plight happening that they would like to help out. Perhaps they've listened to our previous three episodes and have become so...
Impassioned, yes,
that they want to help. What does the next process look like? And I know you mentioned that there's some possible pitfalls of people getting involved too late in the stage, and we might talk about that as well. But how does one bring in a refugee if you're not the government?
Well, the great thing about Canada is we're the only country in the world that allows a group of people to come together and do a private sponsorship, put the money together, and take the responsibility of inviting bringing a newcomer, helping them settle. Every other country in the world, it's primarily done, better or worse, by government. And actually, the success rates when citizens come together and do it is much better for the new person, because they come into a welcoming community. Mm-hmm. So what we have done is we've learned a lot from the religious communities, and believe it or not, they have been very friendly to us. But they've been doing it for, say, 30 years, and so we've learned from them. And essentially, you bring together a group that's around a dozen people. It could be more, could be less. And the group itself educates themselves about the process, and initially you start to fundraise, because you're responsible as a group for the first year of supporting them in their first year, because they're not eligible for welfare in that first year. Luckily, right now, there's a government program, a Rainbow program, that gives us a few thousand dollars in furniture.
Oh,
that's a nice boost. We're hoping that the Liberal government wants to renew it, and they haven't said anything about that yet. But
well, if they're listening,
We'll just assume no news is good news. How's that?
Yeah.
So far, so good, yeah. Okay, and then the group organizes. We can talk more in detail about this, but we make a plan for the settlement and to take over on everything from finding a family doctor to housing, and each area's got somebody coordinating it, and they could have support. And we have a plan that has every task in every area. And then the group picks somebody that they want. It used to be really hard to find LGBT cases because, you know, the UN doesn't even keep track. They used to have this box that was either married or single. And even for heterosexuals, there is in between there. But they don't, and the gender is still binary. But now because we've been doing this for a few years, we've got some great contacts, and I've got a bunch of cases. So we've grown, and the groups. So a group will, I can give the group a number of cases. It can pick something that's a good fit, and then we go through an application process. And the applications typically are like 100 hours of work.
Oh wow!
Yeah.
That's quite a substantial piece. But, I mean, you're also... I mean, it would make sense that the government would expect, you know, 100 hours at least from you, given that, you know, you're bringing someone in that you'll be responsible for in some ways. So, I mean, I'm sure to folks, 100 hours sounds like an awful lot. You know, that's like 3 weeks of work if you're full-time. You know, that's a lot of a lot of time on that.
That's not particular to the queer situation. It's mm-hmm. just that you have to prove that somebody really is a bona fide refugee mm-hmm. and that they are persecuted in their original country, and the country that they're in, the secondary country, is also very dangerous for them, and you have to prove that. And we also work with these outlaw students, who mm-hmm. law students who volunteer a lot mm-hmm. of time, and they've helped do country research. And so whenever we do an application, we like to make it excellent so that there's no question they'll get through. And the other thing about the government is that you have to, they ask you the same question in many different ways, mm-hmm. in long form that takes about 10 pages, and then in paragraph form, and in pithy two sentences, and nothing can contradict. And if it does, then they assume that, you know, you're lying and bringing in a terrorist, you know.
I mean, we laugh, but I mean, this is a very serious concern. I mean, in the United States, the terror fear is what has blocked a lot of refugees coming in. You know, a lot of, was it like 39 governors wanted to block immigration for refugees after the Paris attacks? You know, it's something that is a real concern. And I think you're right, you know, things have improved. I think when we talked to Michael Casasola and some of the other ones, they're now recording JLBT refugees at the point where they meet the UN. Which I would imagine has been a great help to yourself.
Well, even then, saying things are improving is a bit reductive. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a very big simplification. It depends on where they're from, where they're going, mm-hmm. what their context is. A lot of our guests from the past few weeks pointed out that in the context of Canada and in the context of sub-Saharan Africa, it's getting easier. In the context of South Asia, it is neither easier nor more difficult. It's just changing. Mm-hmm. It's changing the flavor of complexity.
Yeah. And sometimes these institutions, it's hard to bring about a whole institutional change, because mm-hmm. the UNHCR has been good because they brought forward a whole policy document about SOGI claims, sexual mm-hmm. orientation and gender identity. But the same people still work there.
I like that acronym.
Just yesterday, I got a file from a lesbian couple that's in Turkey. And they, when they went to the UN, the UN said, oh, we don't take sexual, you know, lesbians, we don't take homosexuals. So you have to apply as individuals. You're not a couple.
Hmm.
And that's terrible. That's in violation of their policy, but they've got the same person working at the door that they've always had, you know?
Yeah. And I think that really speaks mountains. You know, it's, you know, there can be a lot of change at the higher levels, but, I mean, if something doesn't change on the ground, then that becomes incredibly difficult. What do you think the success is? Because we've heard from some folks that, you know, the government brought in 20 or 25,000, I forget which, refugees through the official route. But there has been so many refugees brought in through through private sponsorship. Anecdotally, how many do you think that you've seen come through that way, through private sponsorship?
You mean with our group has touched about 14 cases. And we're hoping to make it 16.
Wow, that is
you
phenomenal.
Know, individuals, I'm saying, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. The first goal, I think, is safety.
Mm-hmm.
That we in the process that we allow them to own their own stories and keep their life confidential and safe, and that they're not outed in any ways about their identity that is not their choice. And the other part of that is empowerment, so that we give them the tools that they need to be able to settle and then help them make the decisions about their own lives.
Now, you mentioned safety, and I think this speaks to the conversation we had a little bit earlier and just outside when I was saying, you know, what if folks want to get involved and, you were talking about not really having a revolving door on that committee that puts it together. So just for the, you know, you mentioned earlier about how these groups that bring in refugees are usually around a dozen people. How does one become a group that is bringing in a refugee? Like, how does that process happen?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we're just kind of figuring this out organically as we go along. And Capital Rainbow Refuge started in 2010. And at that time, we formed a group of people, and we made a commitment to take on the job and educated ourselves. And there's a lot of information about what we needed to learn. And also, we undertook things like cultural awareness and you know, studied, we committed everybody to a code of conduct and confidentiality, and we, and then when we picked somebody and we went through a process, and at that point, you know, when you pick somebody and you make a commitment to them, you're a support group to an individual, and you don't want to be completely fluid about having people pop in and out of their lives, because it's like having a family member that appears and then disappears, and it can be, and the newcomer might, you know, feel if the group gets too big, it's hard to trust too, right? Yeah. And you want to be there, and you want to be reliable. So you want the group to commit to be there. It's at least a 2-year commitment between the application time and the settlement. And if you're lucky, then they could stay in your life longer. But it's up to them. You know, they have a right to move. But you know, the mobility is, part of the constitution in our country. Mm-hmm. And but it's just that. So when at a certain point, we started to feel like people wanted to keep joining us, and it became awkward. So we said, we'll help you start a group. Mm-hmm. And this is how we morphed into doing mentorships with other groups and helping other people set up groups. And then we got a process where we were able to give charitable donations and also help people do faster sponsorships, because there's a group of five process that can be very slow, and then there's working with a sponsorship agreement holder. And we got set up on a faster track, so we've been able to offer up two other groups to work with us to get charitable donations and the faster track. But in doing that, because we're officially liable for that, we also wanted to make sure that we only really wanted to work with people who had we share values with, that are not going to do things that would maybe hurt somebody, and then we'd be dragged in with it. And so we developed some workshops. We developed four workshops that are a couple hours long, and Eve is somebody who came and approached us and said that he was interested in setting up a group, and we said that we would help him. And
so, Eve, do you mind talking us through your experience of why did you reach out to Capital Rainbow Refuge, and kind of from that stage of, how did you come to the decision to bring in a refugee, and then perhaps we'll follow that process?
I've been concerned about the life of people of LGBTs around the world living in countries where it is actually illegal to be gay or punishable by death. And for a number of years, I've been trying to find ways to help individuals in other countries to actually fight back and survive in very difficult situations. And then we all know of the infamous pictures that circulated on the internet of the little boy, the little Syrian boy that was there. And that said, my God, I really have to do something. And I realized that, you know, the government was saying we will not take in single men to the exception of gay men. And I said, oh, my God, so maybe there is a way to that I can do something to try to get somebody to have a new chance in Canada. So I did some research on the net. I didn't know anybody at Rainbow Refuge at this point, but eventually I did find Lisa, and on December 22nd, I know the date precisely, I went to a meeting at Lisa's place, and I thought that we were going to create the group that night, and we were going to do it, and in a couple months he was going to arrive. I was very naive, but I was very motivated, and I said, I'm going to be... I saw that it wasn't going to happen that night, and I said, I'm going to recruit the people. So I went through my network of people I knew. I was probably contacted 40 people before I was able to find 12 that really wanted to commit themselves to 2 years. It's not something that you do and say, oh, I'd like to take them grocery shopping. Well, okay, that's all nice, but you need to be part of something bigger. Mm-hmm. And the bigger thing at the beginning is you need to raise the funds. I had a group that did not have necessarily a lot of funds, but we were lucky to be accepted by Swirl and Twirl this year, and Swirl and Twirl allowed us to raise $7,400 for this cause, and we sold more tickets than was ever sold by any beneficiary group for Swirl and Twirl.
And just for the benefit of our listeners, Swirl and Twirl is like a wine and cheese fundraising initiative hosted in the Ottawa community, just to kind of give a bit of context for our listeners.
It's held yearly, and every year they choose three different LGBT groups to be sponsored. So we were one of the three, and that was, in our case, the way that we did it. For the rest of it, you ask for personal donation to your family, your friends, and people that feel that that they need to do that. And certainly the listeners that wish to donate, they are very welcome to either contact the Cavill Rainbow Refuge or my group, which is called Rainbow New Beginnings, because we feel we need to give a chance to mm-hmm. people to have a new beginning in life, and that they deserve it.
We're actually, our group has identified two cases that we're moving ahead on right now, and they're both young people, and in each case there's a young woman fleeing forced marriage.
Oh wow.
And their families, they have a family violence honor killing is just because of not wanting to get married, and if they knew that they were queer then it would be worse. So one is a single woman from the Middle East, and the other is a trans couple with a baby.
Oh wow.
From Asia. And on that, we're looking at a budget that's about 58K, and we still need 20K to make it happen. And we really, because of the way the application works, we have to commit the money pretty much up front, 75% up front. Mm-hmm. So we really want to submit the trans couple right away. It's so hard, you know, we've been... They're so isolated right now in the country where they are because they're not legally allowed to work, and they can barely afford their rent. They don't have any money coming in, right? They can't mm-hmm. afford their rent. We're sending them money for rent. But, you know, that these cases, there's people are... It's so motivating to be able to help people. And I find that, I mean, you might get into it because you want to help somebody else, but the people that you meet give back this strength and value of life, and that can't help but shower you with more value and give you a reason to keep going. Because I've learned so much from the people we've sponsored.
We may as well definitely plug it in, and we'll talk a little bit more in just a few moments. But if you do want to donate, you can check out capitalrainbow.ca. And the website for Rainbow New Beginnings is?
It's on Facebook. It's Rainbow New Beginnings, and there'll be a link to donate through chimp.net.
Excellent. And we'll be back talking about that. I'd like to touch on some of the things you raised about, you know, the real impact, because these are incredible people you're talking about. But this is Adieu by Cris de Perret from the album Blonde, and we'll be back in just a few minutes. Sebastian's laughing at me because I butchered the pronunciation again.
Cœur de pirate.
Excellent, de pirate, yeah. Excellent. Okay, we'll be back just after this.
ça va comme ça. Mes amis, j'en ai plein déjà. Je n'aurai donc plus à t'entendre rentrer la nuit quand j'attends l'aube qui arrive en poussant les airs. Moi, je me lève et toi, tu meurs.
Hello and welcome back to the Velvet Studio. And I'll just give Sebastian a second just to take his seat. There we go. There he is. And are you all good to go?
Yeah, yes. we're fine.
Excellent,
we're
excellent.
Fine.
Now, everyone laughed at me again after that show, that song, because I still cannot pronounce the name.
I think we're having a Cœur de Pirate moment, the way that we had a Scissor Sisters moment a couple of years ago.
Oh, yeah.
That
so,
might also be a couple
of years ago, the Scissor Sisters released a new album, and I thought it was the best thing since sliced bread. So for about a month straight, we played a lot of Scissor Sisters. And I think I also will have to have a moratorium on Cœur de Pirate. So.
For multiple reasons.
Yes, absolutely. Anyway, moving on. If you know any Canadian GLBT artists, let us know. Tweet us at Velvet Studio 1. We're always keen to promote Canadian artists. The other two artists we have for today are actually not Canadian, so a sad face, but there's good reasons. Anyway, just before we left, you were talking about the amazing story of a trans couple in Asia with a child and really the need to kind of support them and the fact that by the sounds of it, really quite struggling. I wanted to know, because I think some people have this... you mentioned the boy on the beach at the top of the hour, and if you were reading the news, Obama read a letter from a four-year-old, and the four-year-old said that he'd like to share the bedroom with the boy who'd survived the bombing in Aleppo. And it was a beautiful story that was out earlier today. So if you have a chance to go and check that out, please do. But my question is, you know, what kind of impact does once they get here have on the people that are on the refugees? So once they've made the process of coming all the way to Canada, after a few months, what's the kind of impact there?
I would say that day one, the arrival moment, is one of the best days in their life and one of the best days in my life. Just that moment of
elation.
I know, yeah. And there's one guy who, he tells a story about when he walked through the metal detector to enter the country. He put his stuff down and he put his hands on his hips and then he put one hand forward with his hand straight up and then strutted back and forth. And the customs woman said, "Welcome to Canada, Queen."
That's amazing.
And he was so happy, you know, just to have that be welcome. Because in his own country, oh my God, crossing the border was resulted in so many things that were the worst days in his life, you know. So it's night and day. So the experience and the hardship that they bring, personally, I would say that I probably have some post-traumatic stress just because I've heard so many stories, and I feel like I carry them around, and I've got more cases that I deal with than we're ever going to be able to sponsor, and I find that's kind of hard. So maybe I act a bit weird sometimes. But the people that we are able to bring through, there's just so much that they've been able to accomplish. I know the first lesbian couple that we brought here, one of the women was forcibly married at the age of 14.
Oh my gosh.
And from one of the families where it was expected that she'd live in Purda, so that means not leaving the home. So when they came here, she'd never worked before, and she hadn't been, she'd done school by correspondence because she was bright, but all at home on a computer.
Yeah.
So she had to go to school, and it was scary for her. And just because she hadn't been to a doctor for a long time, she was blind, and she needed two cataracts operations. But she decided she couldn't see, but she was going to adult high school. And it was scary for her. She'd never been to school, but she made it there, and she was so scared. But then she worked hard, and she knew what she wanted, and she got the top marks in her class.
Wow.
Yeah, and we were so proud of her.
That is incredible.
And her teachers were impressed, and then they said, you know, we could recommend you for a job, because they always, you know, always want to help your best students. And
mm-hmm.
so she got referred to a big shopping center because her accounting teacher was impressed with her, and so she started working. You know, so she went from a bridge of not, you know, not knowing her potential to taking charge and moving ahead and running her own life. And both she and her partner are now working, and they're independent, and they applied for Canadian citizenship, and they actually have decided they wanted to advance things more. So they're both at Algonquin.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, and we're so proud of them.
That is incredible. And I think that that really shows folks who then become a living part of the Canadian fabric and the Canadian identity. And I think that that's so unbelievably valuable.
And the little moments, you know, like one time my phone rang, and she said, and this woman said she wanted to share something with me. She hadn't told me that she had applied for college, because, well, anyway. But then she said, "I just wanted you to know, you're the first person I've called. I've been accepted."
Oh, that is fantastic.
And we both had a cry, and we were so happy, you know. So being able to share those moments is mm-hmm. Really, really special.
Now, Eve, I think we were going to talk a bit about your experiences and the process that you've gone through as well. Did you want to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, just a little bit of on my background. I got infected by the HIV virus in 1984, so 32 years ago. And I, one of the survivors, and one of the prices that I had to pay is I became legally blind in 2002. And I wrote articles about what my condition was that came from HIV, and it got posted on the net, and I get all sorts of letters and emails from people that explain that they live in a country where they know that they're HIV positive, but they don't want to go for treatment mm-hmm. because that would mean outing them. So what they do is they take natural remedies and all sorts of different quack remedies that because they don't want to do that. And I find out later on that they have passed away. It's very sad because you've established that connection. In the countries where AIDS is, not AIDS, but being gay is punishable by death, only 14% of the people that live with HIV access treatment, and the main reason why they don't is because they fear that that would be akin to admitting that they are homosexual and putting their lives at risk. This in itself motivates me to wanting to do something about it. So this group is here. That yeah. doesn't necessarily mean that the person that we will select will necessarily be HIV positive, because from what I know from Lisa and people that have gone through this, every single case has very complex issues and may require different types of attention.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think when we were talking to Michael Cansasola, I want to say 17% of refugees actually get kind of put under the UN recognition. Like, the only, you know, it's a very small percentage actually who do it. And I think they said they have 400,000 persons of interest out of the millions of folks who are displaced. And we did talk about yesterday about a lot of regional refugees, so folks who move from one country to the one next door, and maybe they'll move back, and maybe they'll move back and forward.
And by yesterday, you mean last week.
That's totally what I meant. And, you know, and I think you've brought in a really interesting perspective. If someone is living with some kind of chronic illness, you know, it surely it becomes that much more difficult to come into Canada. I know that in the general, just in the normal visa process, if I had diabetes and I was from Britain trying to come to Canada, that would have an effect on my ability to come in because of the chronic illness element. Is it more difficult from the cases you've seen to bring in someone living with something like HIV?
The great thing about Canada is it's not a barrier to come into our country.
Oh, excellent. But,
I think that in
the
80s...
Is it a complication? Like, is it I think just like one extra form?
In the 80s, the government did try to say it would be a burden on the healthcare system, but the courts batted that down. The courts have been good to us as queer people in this country, and we have gained quite a few rights through that. But Canada is more enlightened, I think, in that front. Every once in a while, there are countries like Australia has been really banning a lot of queer people because they've decided that they don't allow refugees or immigrants if they don't have family ties already in Australia. Mm-hmm. And especially gay people are not going to have family if family's trying to kill them. There have been some real... we've seen quite several cases of like gay men in Turkey, which is it's really hard in Turkey. There's for refugees, there's very little way to work because there's so many refugees, and you end up having to work illegally if you can. And so there's some gay men that have found their ticket finally came through with the UNHCR, and then they sent them to Australia, and Australia said lack of family ties, and then bumped them back to the end of the line.
Jeez.
So you think why did the UNHCR do that, knowing that Australia has that process, and you know.
To my knowledge, there's only two conditions that would exclude somebody from coming to Canada as a refugee, and that's tuberculosis and Ebola.
Mm-hmm. Ebola would make sense.
Communicable diseases.
Which make much more sense. But I mean, we're talking about folks living in refugee camps, and when we're talking about Michael Casasola, he was pointing out, and I'm glad you mentioned Turkey, that a lot of refugees. We have this kind of this picture, I think, which was really coming out of the 90s of, you know, a desert with dust bowls and massive tents, and you know, it's a huge tent-style refugee camp. Well, you know, the more accurate picture is that a lot of people are living in urban centres such as Istanbul. Other big cities in the regional countries, and they're working, they're probably street involved or homeless, and they're working jobs illegally and so on and so forth because they're urban refugees as opposed to camp refugees. Mm-hmm.
The world is more metropolitan than a lot of people understand. I mean, it's really interesting when you look at aerial photos of the major cities in Africa. They're huge, absolutely huge. You don't have, 4 million people living in a capital city and they're all living in adobe brick houses. I mean, that's mm-hmm. ridiculous. They have glass malls and they have highways, and it's mm-hmm. these countries are they're either modern or they're modernizing incredibly quickly.
Well, refugee camps have been very dangerous places for mm-hmm. LGBT. If you look, and I should say refugee camps are just terrible places anyway for any refugee. The average time to get out of a refugee camp is 18 years.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. There, and if you look at Kenya, there's a large refugee camp there called Kakuma. Mm-hmm. And there, if there are refugees from Uganda, which is a neighboring country, then people know that they're the only refugees who leave Uganda are gay. So just the fact of being in the refugee camp right next door means that they have been harassed by Kenyans. And in Kenya, I think that it's up there with about 97% who find homosexuality completely unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with that most refugees face is, in order to become a refugee, you have to leave your country. Nobody leaves the country unless they really have to. So if somebody leaves, it's because their life was threatened. But then most of the places that have this, there's 78 countries in the world where sexual orientation is criminalized, including 8 or so with the death penalty. And the countries right next door, the countries they can get to, it's impossible, actually. It's very, very difficult to get to a country that has humane laws because we have visa restrictions. So the countries they can get to mostly are next door, and they're equally homophobic. And then they can't work. So they're illegal. They're at risk. they're at risk from their own community that might identify them. So, like in Kenya, the criminal laws are it's between 14 and 21 years for sexual orientation jailing.
And it's not just the jailing. A few months ago, we talked to Maurice Tomlinson, who is working with Jamaica.
Oh, right.
And the conversation there we were talking about is, you know, if you've got folks who are homeless or working illegally, in particular gay men, they are substantially more at risk of becoming infected with HIV and other
or being killed, and then the state doesn't really care to prosecute the people who killed them. I think they've probably done everybody a favor. Mm-hmm. So in this, in Kakuma, this refugee camp, there is an area within the refugee camp just for the queer people that's walled off. So it's effectively a jail within a jail.
Mm-hmm.
And I have mentioned it to you a few times that it would be a dream to be able to get all those people out, to get them here.
Yeah. And if folks want to help out, I think there's certainly ways that we can that you can do that. But there's some ways where it would be impractical. And we'll be talking about... Well, let's talk about the impractical ways. And I was just flicking through your settlement plan, which is very exciting and so thoroughly detailed. Like, you have a housing team coordinator, which is, you know, explaining rights and obligations of lease and renting. I know somebody who tried to leave an apartment and gave notice halfway through or in a couple of days and said, you know, the end of the following month I'll be leaving. And, you know, the landlord was saying, no, I don't accept your leaving statement. And I'm like, you can't keep people in you can't trap them in an apartment building. That's not how it works in Canada. So I mean, this is a Canadian I'm talking to, and I'm like, you know, if we're struggling sometimes with lease negotiations, then, you know, these little things coming up, you know, it's how many times have you had a refugee and then something's come up that you've never thought would need to be explained or that you've never had to think about?
The lease is a fun one, because usually when you start, you have to sign 12 months, sign mm-hmm. a whole year. And then when the year comes up, they think they have to sign another year. But when we inform them that you don't actually have to, all you have to do is inform your landlord you want to go month to month. Really? Another one that's really, especially from people from the Middle East, is that they don't have a lot of understanding of interest. Mm-hmm. So you often have to explain several times the difference between a credit card and a debit card. And one is your money and the other is the bank's money. And if you spend the bank's money in 1 month, you'll have to pay you have to pay back your $100, but you'll also have to pay $20 on that. So in 1 month, if you don't pay back, you'll have to pay them $120. Really? You know, it's kind of a shock, because that's mm-hmm. considered usury, that interest. They don't have other things that they do, but they really don't have an understanding of interest. So that's and you can't get a very difficult to get a cell phone without a credit card.
This is true. Yeah, absolutely. And I think when you were talking about the group of 12, and we've talked about how people might want to jump in and help, but that puts folks at risk, because these people are fleeing. A lot of them have post-traumatic stress disorder, difficulty trusting. So maybe jumping into the bandwagon of a group that's already underway might not be the best, but we'll be talking about in a couple of moments about perhaps some of the ways where people can get involved, which doesn't put the trust at risk that we talked about earlier. This is a song, the song Colors by Halsey, who is actually from New Jersey. And the reason I brought her up is either this week or last week was Bisexuality Awareness Month. The BuzzFeed did an article that discussed whether or not Halsey was bisexual, and because she had male partners and presented as feminine, they decided that she wasn't particularly, which she understandably took offense to, because that's the definition of bi erasure, mm-hmm. denying someone's experience. So this is a bit of a nod to bisexuality.
Anita Franco more famously went through that. She married a man and everybody said, "You're not a lesbian anymore." And she said, "I was never a lesbian. I was bisexual the whole time."
Mm-hmm.
It turned into a thing.
I can
you remember
see
all that?
That?
Yeah.
It was the early 2000s. It was weird.
Dude. Anyway, this is Colors by Halsey, and we'll be back just after this, looking about how you can practically help folks on the ground above and beyond donating directly.
On her TV show, you're only happy when
when your sorry head is filled with dope. I hope you make it to the day you're 28 years old. You're dripping like a saturated sunrise. You're spilling like an overflowing sink. You ripped at every edge, but you're a masterpiece. And now you're tearing through the pages and the ink. Everything is blue. His pills, his hands, his jeans. And now I'm covered in the colors, pull apart at the seams. And it's blue. And it's blue. Everything is gray. His hair, his smoke, his dreams. And now he's so devoid of color, he don't know.
Decided purple just wasn't for you.
Everything is blue. His pills, his hands, his jeans. And now I'm covered in the colors, pull apart at the seams. And it's blue. And it's blue. Everything is gray. His hair, his smoke, his dreams. And now he's so deep.
Hello and welcome back to the
Velvet Studio.
That's the one.
Yeah.
I listened back to that and it was a bit more poppy than I remembered. So yeah, I want to apologize for people who get insulted by pop music.
Never make everyone happy.
This is true. This is true.
Who gets insulted by the music of Michael Jackson?
Oh, this is true. He was the king.
He was the king of
this
pop.
This is also true. Very much so. We wanted to talk about
Elvis. Elvis was the king.
Well, yeah, this is true.
Elvis was the king of rock and roll.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. And what about, what's his face? Tutti Frutti. Who did that?
Oh, Little Richard? He was one of the fathers of rock and roll.
Yeah. This is true.
Yeah.
One of the gay godfathers of rock and roll. Great actor. Anyway, we're totally off topic here. I was just flicking through your Selma plan again, and I just think it's amazing. Is it difficult to get people to commit to being one of these roles? Like, you have finances coordinator. I imagine that's probably quite a task. You know, how do you get people to not only commit to a 2-year commitment, and perhaps Eve, you can talk about maybe how you persuaded people most recently, but how do you get them to be like, you know, we've got this person who I can't tell you much about, And we'd like you to devote 2 hours and 2 years and at least 100 hours on the application to putting together. That's a tall order. We can't get people to get a piggyback from Sebastian.
It's true.
So, you know, if you want a piggyback, tweet us at Velvet Studio One. offer's still out there. But how do you get people to actually commit to that?
Well, you have to explain what the process is and what the end goal is, and essentially is to save someone because they are in very dire situations. That even though it is 2 years, it's not a full-time job. That at the beginning you have a meeting every second week, and of course when you get closer to the event, then it gets more intense, and I tried to look at all the roles and look at the different friends and see whether or not I had somebody that that really wanted to have this role or that role, and who wanted the health coordinator role. And And finally, I ended up that I didn't have anybody as a treasurer. So the last one that came in, I said, would you like to do that? And he says, not really, but I'll do it because I believe in it. This is not always the case. But, you know, a treasurer, you don't need to be a CGA to be a treasurer. Mm-hmm. Essentially, you have to understand how a bank account works and how transfers work, and have a little bit of money coming in and money going out. And that's pretty much what you need to know.
Excellent. How much time do you spend with refugees once they do land? I know that the individual that you're looking to bring in hasn't got here yet, but what's the commitment once they've crossed the tarmac?
That really depends what your job is, right? I mean, the finance person might have very little involvement. Maybe a few conversations where you'd be explaining the budget, because what we do is transfer money every 2 weeks to them, mm-hmm. and help them understand what the dollar buys in Canada. But we're not going to hold their hand for all that stuff. So we transfer the money to them, and then they're responsible for making it work. Mm-hmm. So we're not going to moralize about them if they smoke or don't smoke. And, you know, we give them their sure. money, and that's up to them. So the finance person needs to explain very clearly that we support them for 12 months, and every 2 weeks we're going to send you this amount of money. And then, somebody else has a housing job, and their job is to take the newcomer around to find an apartment that they can afford. And the goal of that is for it to be a place that is sustainable, so that after our funding ends, that we don't want them to have to move. That would be very disappointing or depressing for them. So the goal of it is to find a place that they can pay for themselves. And the housing job, it seems like it's actually practical about finding a place concretely, but the housing is often a journey about who they are and where they can be and mm-hmm. how to negotiate themselves in our society. So that one is good to have somebody with a lot of patience who can take them to, don't take them to the best place at the beginning, you know, take them to a place they can't afford, take them to a dive that they can afford but wouldn't want to live in. And then they'll understand, their own place in that. And also it's good to be able to have them be close enough to social transit so they're not isolated. So there's other factors like that. But so every different jobs have a different level of engagement.
Excellent. Now, for folks who don't want to sign up for those massive commitments, how do you know what, you know, let's say I'd like to help Eve's group. But of course, I can't sign up to be the housing coordinator now. I think that boat has quite promptly sailed. You know, what practical way can I contribute above and beyond donating? What practical way can I contribute if I was to call you up and be like, you know what, Eve, I really want to do something. What can I do?
Well, as we said before, joining the group at this point is not an option. There's always money. I mean, money always is needed. And even though you may be at a certain process, a certain advancement in your project, there's still things that happen that are unforeseen. So that's for sure. Sometimes you can help in terms of getting furniture. getting things that the person will need. At this point, we have helped the person who's going to be temporary lodging to get what he needs to receive the person. But when we get to the point where the newcomer has arrived, has indicated what type of places that they want, then there's more work to be done mm-hmm. to get whatever needs that they need. So at that point, I would be posting what I need on my Facebook page and say, this is some of the things that we are looking for. Is there anybody around that has two very small bedside tables that that would fit in a one-bedroom apartment?
I have a kettle. If I've got a spare kettle. You know, is it things like that that you know? Perhaps
yeah, we have one of the things we have is we have a gifts committee. We don't mm-hmm. like to call it donations because we learned that some cultures think that secondhand things don't have value, but if it's a mm-hmm. gift, it has value.
Yeah.
So our gifts group has developed a really extensive list about all the things that could go into an apartment.
Oh wow!
And
well, even more than that, actually, something that I've heard from a lot of my friends who. None of them were refugees per se, but friends who've immigrated to Canada. Everybody underestimates Canadian winters, and it's they know that it's going to be cold, and they get winter clothes, but it doesn't occur to them that until they climatize, like in the winter, I usually just wear a sweater over a sweater. I am very much a cold weather guy. People look at me and they're like, "How are you not dying from the cold?" And so if somebody looks at pictures of what Canadians look like in the winter and they think, well, you know, somebody's given me a winter coat, someone's given me a toque, someone's given me a scarf, I should be fine. Well, in the first couple winters, they're going to need to double down. They're going to be wearing way more than you and I as they still get used to what it's like to be in 40 below. One of my friends who's from Turkey now in the winter, he just wears a hoodie and a leather jacket. But when I first met him, no, he was under like five layers as he was still getting used to it. So everybody always underestimates the winter weather. And having not just a coat, but also other things they can wear under the coat is something that is often overlooked. So clothing donations is one thing, but like winter coats is... A good winter jacket is very expensive. You can get a bed for the cost of a good winter jacket sometimes.
Yeah, we have an allocation of about $500 per person is what our group tends to do for winter clothing.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
sometimes what I've been able to do is engage like somebody who likes to shop, who has money. Like sometimes people in our culture, in our community, they like to spend money. So, you know, to encourage people to match that themselves, you know, by going out and buying things, and so yeah. there's a list, but I'd like to engage the newcomer in a budget for saying there's this much money and you can spend, and this is what we recommend is long underwear, turtleneck, mm-hmm. a fleece, mm-hmm. and a coat, and some things we have that are donated to. And
so just before we wrap up, in terms of socializing, because I imagine that these folks coming aren't going to be shut-ins, hiding under the bed, as it were. You know, is it a way for folks to spend time, play a board game? You know, what kind of socializing happens with folks once they get here to kind of, you know, kind of alleviate the boredom, I would imagine?
Well, we've been told that you really need to keep people busy so they don't get depressed. Early on, you go for a language assessment and you can get them in school. If they do need to go to school, then there is free language training for permanent residents before they become citizens. And we have an orientation committee, and we really encourage the group to take people around, and we have group potlucks. And Eve, you've got, do you want to add to that?
No.
Okay, so, you know, museums, and give somebody a bike, and we had one of the groups we worked with taught them how to ride the bike.
Wow.
And, you know, got them in a course for how to ride a bike, and then got to explore Ottawa that way. We have had the pleasure of working with some other groups, too, like ORFA, the Ottawa Rainbow Friendship Alliance, and Baker's Dozen, and they're both hoping to sponsor, and we're working with them as well as Rainbow New Beginnings. And so if anybody wants to to form a group. You know, don't hesitate to be in touch, and we'd be happy to help you get that going.
And you can reach them at capitalrainbowrefuge.ca. That is
That's capitalrainbow.ca.
Capitalrainbow.ca. Sorry, I read the card and it rolled off the tongue. Capitalrainbow.ca.
Yeah, we just launched a new website yesterday. It works on your phone.
Oh, nice. Sadly, that is all we have time for. Thank you so much for joining us. That wraps up our Refugee Month. I think we've definitely described how you can get involved. We're playing out with Stray.
Or introduced how you can get
Absolutely.
Involved. We haven't completely covered it, obviously.
We are playing out with Garrick Stray, which was kind of a letter to a younger self. It's a really interesting song. By an openly gay artist about what he would tell his much younger self. Anyway, that's all we've got time for today, and have a great day.
Thank you for listening.
Thanks. Bye-bye. For having us.